One of the wonders of the world, studied right here at home. Inside the Egyptian pyramids, today, in the Upper Cumberland. Chances are you have not heard of the American Institute for Pyramid Research. The better chance is you didn't know it was based in Crossville. Larry Paul has been studying pyramids for decades, including dozens of trips to Egypt to get inside those historic places. Larry Paul, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Be honored to sit in the studio with you, Larry.
What is the American Institute for Pyramid Research?
Well, you know, I just got today, someone asked me to fill out a series of questions that's going to put me into a magazine article or something. It wasn't. So the first question was like, what influences or who would you want to honor? Like, nobody gets to where they are because there wasn't somebody. And so the first thing I thought of was Adam Rutherford. Adam Rutherford wrote a series of four books called Pyramidology. If you do a Google search for him, you'll find they're available. And he spent more of his life studying the Great Pyramid than anybody else I know. I can name a lot of people. I've got a huge pyramid library, probably one of the biggest in the world. But I don't know of anyone who's probably spent more time studying the Great Pyramid specifically. In his books, Pyramidology, even though it seems like a generic term about all pyramids, really deals, his books really deal with the Great Pyramid. Well, he started in Harpenden, England, the Institute of Pyramidology. And then when he died, his son took it over, and his son died tragically in a car accident. I was trying to think of his son's first name. I can't remember. As a young man, I heard his son speak in Park Ridge. You know, the Institute was still in Harpenden, England, but they had a worldwide reach with pamphlets and the books that they published. And I used to get their quarterly newsletter, I think. So when the son died suddenly and the wife wasn't interested at all, the Institute of Pyramidology came to an end. It came to an end. I thought to myself, wow, what a great resource lost. Now, this was right at the infancy of the internet. I thought, you know what? I don't have the means to have a publishing house. I can't publish book. I can't send mail all around the world, the expense. But I can start something that's, you know, cyber, you know. And so I formed the American Institute of Pyramidology. And then since that name has taken on kind of an esoteric term, I changed it. And now it's officially registered as a not-for-profit corporation in the state of Tennessee as the American Institute for Pyramid Research.
Now, here's the interesting part.
Okay.
Is it's based in Cumberland County. Right?
Yeah, because my address is in Cumberland County. And so people are sometimes when they put it, because Google Maps went to making Google Maps the headquarters for all businesses. It used to be that if you were updating your business information for Stonecom Radio, you'd send it. Now it goes to Google Maps. So
right.
When people put in my address, you know, 184 Canterbury Drive, Crossville, they're shocked that it comes up the American Institute of Pyramid Research because it's largely I have associates. I deal with a lot of people. I don't have any employees though. So I direct the research, of the Institute, and I do have a lot of people I work with, but again, no employees. It's an association-based relationship, and so I continued what I felt like was the loss of the world. Adam Rutherford and his son are dead. The Institute came to an end. Although someone told me they're still in Harpenden, England. It still exists as an institution somehow. And I'm leading a tour to Stonehenge and some other places in England, so I'm probably going to stop there and find out in the fall. But so that's how the American Institute of Pyramid Research came about.
Yeah, I just think it's so fun because you probably wouldn't think of Crossville, Tennessee, or you probably wouldn't even think of Tennessee as a place that there would be an Institute of Pyramid Research. I mean, the only pyramid we have is in Memphis, right? And
that's
not even real.
Yeah, so it's the model of the Great Pyramid. Is it a scale model of the Great Pyramid? Yeah, that's interesting. That's right, yeah.
How'd you get interested in pyramids?
Well, you know, I loved the idea of prophecy when I was a young man. And so I read all of Nostradamus' prophecies. I read Bible prophecy. I read a couple other, you know, sources of prophecy. I was always, anytime something prophetic came up, I wanted to get my hands on it. So somebody once told me the Great Pyramid was a prophecy of sorts. And I thought, wow. And so that led me to study the Great Pyramid. And while I do think it has a prophetic element, that sort of gravitated me away from prophecy and just into studying pyramids. But the way I would I would submit it might have a prophetic value is that I really believe that the explanation for all the tremendous claims that are made about the Great Pyramid, you know, it's got phi, you know, pi, square root of two, you know, it's got metrology. As a matter of fact, most people that really study it say it's in Peter Tompkins' book about the Great Pyramid. It's a scale model of planet Earth. It's a 1/43,200th scale model of planet Earth. If you take the, you know, the circumference of the Earth and then you relate it to the square base of the pyramid, it's a 1/40 to 43,200. And so all of that, what is the source of all that? Well, the legends go back to Enoch, that he was said that the pillar of Enoch was going to do two things. It was going to encode all the science of the ancients. So, you know, measurements, astronomy, you know, geometry, sacred geometry, those things. But it was also going to warn of catastrophes to come. And so in that sense, I think that the Great Pyramid is ultimately the fulfillment of the Pillar of Enoch. Maybe there was actually literal pillars, but it said he was going to build two, one in case fire came to destroy the earth and one in case it was a flood. But I think the ancient world lived much more in fear of catastrophes maybe than we do. The constellation Orion, for instance, is revered by so many ancient cultures. And Orion is this, you know, this judgment symbol. I've never written a book about that, as a matter of fact. Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock popularized the idea of the Orion correlation theory. You know, in Egypt, they said, as above, so below. So in the heavens, you've got this constellation Orion with the three belt stars. So Bovall suggested that the Egyptians brought that belt down to Earth and the three big pyramids at Giza, Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure, that those three pyramids correspond to the three belt stars of Orion. Well, I've done a lot of different, I've made a lot of discoveries in Egypt and spent a lot of time there. And so I thought, well, that's just a belt theory. Like if my wife asked me after this interview, well, what kind of guy is Larry? What kind of questions did he ask you? Well, I don't know, but he's got a nice belt. Well, what, you know, well, I don't know, he's got a nice belt. In other words, a belt doesn't really define Orion. So I thought to myself, what about Orion's shoulder? What about his head? Mysa, the star Mysa is his head. Betelgeuse is the shoulder, Bellatrix. You know, the feet, Rigel is the foot. And then the club stars, you know, and then he's holding a defeated lion, you know, lion skin over here. So what I did is I found a way that I think the Egyptians laid down all of Orion on Egypt, and that's what I wrote a book about. You know, that in other words, it's not just the belt stars, it's the whole constellation. And so I found places where there were connections between stars and pyramids. But in doing the research, I also found that where there weren't pyramids, there were other messages. And so, you know, if you truly let your research guide you and you don't have a preordained conclusion, I really made, I think, some profound discoveries in doing that. But, you know, that's... So that book was called Enoch, Egyptian New Orion Connection Hypothesis. Instead of saying the Orion Correlation Theory, which is the standard name correlating, I made it connect to Enoch because I think it's the pillar of Enoch, Egyptian New Orion Connection Hypothesis. And so...
He's Larry Paul. He is the director of the American Institution for Pyramid Research, as we continue. Do you bring him water in case it was not any good? Is that what you're saying?
Thank you. Thanks so much. Oh, it's very good.
Yeah. Larry Paul is our guest as we talk pyramids. All right. I'm going to ask you to middle school it for us because there's a lot of us that have slept since middle school. The basics of the pyramids. First of all, what time period are we talking about that they were constructed?
Okay. So... this, I don't know if middle schoolers get into these kind of controversies, but that's a huge debate. You just touched a huge sore spot. I mean, there, when I gave a talk in Crossville, I give one talk every year at the library that's it's in Fairfield Glade. And this last one was a packed house because they put my picture in the paper locally. And so a lot of people came. It was my third annual. I'll be doing my fourth annual this year. And somebody walked out because they didn't like my answer to the basic question you're asking me right now. So let me tell you what the controversy is, okay? So because the pyramids are so amazing They're outside the capability of these stupid old Aboriginal Egyptians, so they had to be either aliens or Atlantis. Those are the two big, and if people that don't say Atlantis, they say a now defunct and gone ancient high-tech civilization. And I can name a bunch of, you know, people that are in that school and have a lot of followers. And
what a shock that a conspiracy theory has ended this.
So a lot of people believe that religiously, and I think I probably did before I really looked at the evidence. And I can name other people that now don't have that opinion that started with that opinion. Once you do your homework, and you know, even saying that to them, they get mad at you. But if you really do the homework, the pyramids were built by Egyptians. So the simple answer to your question is it's about 2500 BC. In other words, there's the Egyptian, like a lot of ancient chronologies, there's debates among academics about the exact dates, but it's going to be roughly 2500 BC. So about 4,500 years ago from the present. So that's if you say the Egyptians built them. And, you know, there's a couple lines of evidence that I use because, again, I come all the time in my work against these people that believe it. Probably fewer believe it was aliens, but some of those people believe that strongly. But the more, I'd say the more robust group believe it was Atlantis or some other ancient high-tech civilization. And, you know, the main type of evidence they offer are really things like drill holes. So there are holes that are made that look to be, you know, perfectly round or very round. Oh, the Egyptians didn't have the technology to do that. Now, that's not evidence of an advanced high-tech civilization necessarily. If you can demonstrate that Egyptians were capable of doing that, because to me, this would be the evidence you need if you're saying there was a previous high-tech civilization. Where's the radio station with microphones? Where's the parking lot for the shopping center? Where's the atomic reactor? Where are the automobiles? Where's the solar panels? That's what a high-tech civilization has. If you just show me a drill hole in stone, and the Egyptians were plainly skilled at stoneworking. They plainly were. And you know, as a matter of fact, I went to a lecture. Douglas Inglis was talking about Fourth Dynasty boats, the Khufu boat, longer than Columbus's boats, the first oldest boat discovered. I think it was right on the south side of the Great Pyramid. Two of them were found, one on the west side of the south and the east side of the south. Both of them are in the Grand Egyptian Museum now. Incredible pieces of technology. No two boards the same. This is no Home Depot 2x4 job. Every piece of wood was a different size, pieced together like a jigsaw puzzle to make the hull of that boat. And the ropes that were there, I used to make my living as a tree topper. You know, I can show you some chainsaw cuts on my arm here. Well, my life was held together by a rope. I could climb a tree safely with the ropes that were made 5,000 years ago, the ropes that were found along with that boat. And the boat is just, you know, a marvel of technology. So the question came to Doug Inglis. I heard him give that talk at the University of Chicago at the Oriental Institute. And it was in the museum that's in the Oriental Institute. And so just people are standing around listening to this guy lecture about the boat. And so an engineer asked a question. He says, were there schools of engineering in ancient Egypt? After this guy had talked about how this boat was. And Doug Inglis' answer was, no, father taught son. Now stop and think about it. What's a better way to get an education? Go to 4 years or 8 years at some college and then learn? Or your father did it, your grandfather did it, your great-grandfather did it their whole life. And they taught you and they taught you and they taught you. So what might seem like a very, you know, homey, you know, homeboy kind of answer, no, father taught son, is really a very profound answer. I think that we know that the rope making capabilities, and I think they use counterweights to lift the stone, so they're good at making rope. They're good at working with rocks. You know, they have a tremendous ability to cut stone, to quarry it. They built the pyramids in a quarry, and so the narrative that's often used by the ancient high tech people is that, oh, you'd have to lay a block every minute for, you know, 185 years working 24/7. You know, no, that's a failure to do your homework. The only tight courses on the pyramid are the two bottom courses, which are the two largest, the two highest courses. If you watch a GoPro video of one of these guys that illegally climbs the pyramid because he wants to get YouTube views, you just watch how the stones are. Flinders Petrie, the father of Egyptology, thought a different pharaoh rule at that time. It's so sloppy up there. So the Great Pyramid has sloppy stonework. There's a gouge into the south side when of the Great Pyramid that was put there when some caliph was trying to, you know, get buried treasure or something. And you can see what the stonework likes on the inside. It's not perfectly cut stones, perfectly fit together. There's fill in there. As a matter of fact, Peter James, who the Egyptian government hired to renovate the pyramids, he wrote a book called Saving the Pyramids by Peter James. Peter James says there's fill. They use fill. They were smart. In other words, not only could they make rope and they could work with stone, but they were practical. You don't have to have every block fit perfectly. Wikipedia will tell you there's 2,300,000 blocks inside the Great Pyramid. Well, I traveled with Zahi Awas in 2014 and 2015, probably the most famous Egyptologist, the guy that's on all the National Geographic specials and everything, and who's basically the face of Egypt. He told me he thought there was like a million blocks in there. So the narrative that there's 2,300,000, which is what Wikipedia says, not necessarily true. That's, you know, if you have to guess on what the average size is, and then you're assuming they're all put together. But they're not. As a matter of fact, the SARS Doppler radar has found 25 new chambers in the Great Pyramid. The scan pyramids, 2017, the muon technology, the muons that are put out by the sun, they can sort of detect voids. They've detected two huge voids in the Great Pyramid, one of which they found for sure. So the science found the void, and then there's an even bigger void that that they're trying to physically get a camera into, an endoscopic camera into now. So there's voids in there. They used fill. They were practical. So it wouldn't take, you know, 700 years working 24 hours a day. That narrative is not based on a real study of how the pyramid's built.
Let me try another question and see if I step in the mud again. How long do we estimate that it took to build them?
Well, Herodotus is called the father of history. He was the Greek historian. And he went down to interview Egyptian priests about the Great Pyramid and other things. And so Herodotus is Flinders Petrie, the father of Egyptology, said Herodotus should generally be believed. The times when he's somewhat, it's dubious, is when he's simply recording what someone told him. Herodotus himself is generally. So I mentioned that as sort of a precursor to the answer. So Herodotus says it took 10 years to build a base. So before they started going up there, because the Great Pyramid is built right near the escarpment. The escarpment's sort of like the cliff face. You can see like 30 faces of the cliff. Why would they have built something that's going to be it's going to be the biggest building in the world for 4,000 years once it's built? It's going to have more weight than any other building. Why would you build it near the edge, you know, take that risk? Well, according to Herodotus, they built 10 years preparing the base. And then I think I'm a little rusty on Herodotus, but I think he says 20 years after that, and they employed 100,000 people. And he says they lifted the stones with, his words were, simple wooden contrivances, I think is the phrase he uses. And so people, I've seen designs of simple, because the Egyptians used different things to leverage water, the shaduf, where you lift and then it scoops up and lifts things. And so machines that could move a block from the ground level to the next level to the next level. And these wooden contrivances were then moved up the pyramid. And so blocks were moved that way. So that's what Herodotus says. In other words, it's a matter of decades. And that would fit. There's some debate about the length of Khufu's reign because they dated by the cattle census or something. And then some scholars say the cattle census was taken every 2 years. And if you do that, which some scholars say it is, then Khufu was reigning that whole time. So it could have been built during the lifetime of Pharaoh Khufu, who's the pharaoh to whom the Great Pyramid is attributed. And so the 20 to 30 year window that Herodotus gives is possible, built on, you know, the idea of the reigns of the Egyptian pharaohs.
Why? Why did they build it?
Well, you know, why when I was dating my wife in Illinois and I took her to an Amish community just because I thought that would be a cool thing. You know, Arcola is one of the cities in Illinois that's an Amish city. So why, when you go into their living room, is there nothing there? Why do the women not have buttons on their shirts? The old women just have straight pins. Well, they avoid any kind of human show. You know, it's like, that's vain. We're just humans. We're going to work hard. They're obviously, you know, good carpenters, good craftsmen, good people, but they don't think they should bring glory to themselves. I think that's exactly what's happening in the Great Pyramid. Not just the Great Pyramid, all the old dynasty pyramids, unlike the temples in the south, which are filled with hieroglyphics, filled with beauty, there's nothing in them except, in most cases, a sarcophagus. The Great Pyramid has a sarcophagus. Menkaure has a sarcophagus that was lost at sea. Khafre has a sarcophagus. But they're nothing else. There's no gold, no silver, no jewels, no hieroglyphics, nothing. How can you build the biggest building in the history of the world and not even put Picasso in the corner, not even sign Khufu anywhere. Now, Khufu's name is in the relieving chambers of the Great Pyramid because those stones are not visible to anybody. It took the dynamite archaeology they sometimes used in the 19th century to blast holes up there to get up to the relieving chambers above the King's Chamber, and there they found workmen's graffiti. And the workmen, I remember I used to write on 2x4s when I was on construction sites. I was a mason laborer and a carpentry laborer when I was a young man. And we sometimes write on 2x4s and stuff. So the writing, the only name, the place where Khufu's name is written is by workman's scribble up above the King's Chamber. So Khufu himself never said, "I, the great and mighty Khufu, built this." As a matter of fact, Herodotus says that Khufu closed all the temples of Egypt while he was building the Great Pyramid. And so Akhenaten is a famous Egyptian pharaoh who challenged the existing theology of Egypt, took the made a new capital in Amarna, and it was very stark and simple. And he just the worship of the one sun god, you know, just a monotheist. And that seems to be what Khufu did, because Khufu was known to have written a book about theology. He was interested in finding the chambers of Thoth, you know, again. Herodotus generally shouldn't be believed. Flinders Petrie says that he closed the temples. Why would he do that? You know, so it seems like he was. So my own sense, and some early archaeologists said that all the panoply of Egyptian gods, you know, because there's so many of them, you know, there's Sekhmet, and you can name all the different gods that are really just different manifestations of the same God. So just like in the Christian Bible, you can say he's the Alpha and Omega, he's the rock, he's the water. He's the bright morning star. All these different metaphors for Jesus are some say that, and so it could be, you know, that's an evidence of a monotheism, that he closed all the other temples and he just wanted to build this one edifice to his God. You know, again, I'd liken it to the stark simplicity of the Amish, you know, home and yet their fear of God and you know, second commandment, don't make any graven images or anything. So something like that. And, you know, there is a passage in the Bible that Adam Rutherford used, who I mentioned at the beginning, or one of the founders of the study of the Great Pyramid in the modern times. And it's Isaiah 19, 19 and 20. It says, "In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt." So just stop there. There should be an altar, and it says, and a pillar near the border thereof. So there would be an altar of the Lord and a pillar near the border. So an altar and a pillar. Well, if you believe the Bible, then where is that? Because here's Isaiah 19, verses 19 and 20, saying, "In that day," seems to be a reference to the second coming, "in that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt and a pillar near the border thereof." The Great Pyramid is in Giza, which means border. A pillar near the border thereof. And this is like a conundrum, because how can something be like in the middle, the table we're sitting at right now, Larry? Well, there's a microphone based in the middle, but my book is over here near the periphery. How can something be both? And the Great Pyramid sort of solves the conundrum, because it's in the middle. It's between Upper and Lower Egypt, so it's in the middle. But it's on the border, because Giza means border, and anciently, pretty much Egypt was just along the Nile. The rest was all uncultivated and undeveloped. And so in practice, you know, the Nile. And so the Great Pyramid is near the border of where the Nile would flood to and where the Sahara Desert is. So in some ways, the Great Pyramid is near the border. In some ways, it's in the midst, because it's in between Upper and Lower Egypt. So it seems to solve the conundrum. So my challenge to somebody else would be, well, that doesn't refer to the Great Pyramid. Okay, what does it refer to? You know, it refers to something in Egypt. That says it as plain as words can say. So the point is, some people would say that places, you know, the Great Pyramid, which would appear to be in this, you know, polytheistic, you know, pagan land of Egypt, you know, it seems to be something that says specifically will be a witness to the Lord of hosts. Isaiah 19, 19, 20, it will be a witness to the Lord of hosts. And so Adam Rutherford, who founded the Institute for Pyramidology, that is where I first started cutting my teeth when I was interested in prophecy, you know, he insisted that it was a revelation of Christian theology. And then there's a whole group of people that followed him in that. You know, C. Piazzi Smith, who was the royal astronomer for the nation of Scotland, had a lot of inventions, published books, was a brilliant man. As a matter of fact, I would say that the reason America doesn't have the metric system is because of C. Piazzi Smith, the Royal Astronomer for Scotland, because he launched a huge campaign against the metric system. He said the metric system was an invention of French infidels at the time, you know, like 1798, at the time of the Enlightenment. And he said, that's a godless system. It's built on tens, the ease of ten. He says, whereas the inherited system of the, you know, imperial system is the one that goes back to the cubit that God gave to Noah, and therefore we need to preserve that system. And that led to a lot of people in America and in Europe following his ideas. There was real kind of a battle at that time. And that, I think, was what led the resistance from America not following what the rest of the world did, going to the metric system. So again, it was built on this idea that this is a revelation from God and we're protecting.
And you're talking to somebody right now, by the way, that had a metric lunchbox in the second grade. So I was one of the last ones.
Because there was a push at one time, remember that, to bring
the metric system. In the 1970s.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
To bring it. So
that's right.
That lunchbox would be worth a fortune today. Larry Paul is our guest. He is the director of the American Institution for Pyramid Research. Fascinating discussion with Larry Paul, who is based right here in the Upper Cumberland and does this research. So, again, back to a basic question. If you were to compare the height of the Great Pyramid, how does it compare to a skyscraper, for example, which would be our modern way of measurement?
It's often said that the Great Pyramid was the tallest structure on Earth for 3,800 years. I've heard that, and I think it was the Lincoln Cathedral that was the first building that was above it. But you know, I don't spout that statistic a lot, so you're putting me on the spot. But it was, you know, it would be something that was built probably in the 18th century, or yeah, maybe the Lincoln Cathedral was before, maybe it was the late Middle Ages probably. But so it's 280 royal cubits high, and there were 20.62 inches in a royal cubit. So if you think of roughly 2 feet for a cubit, 280, you know, double that, it's going to be over 500 feet. And if we say there's 10 feet to a story, is that a 50-story building then?
Yeah,
interesting. That's pretty big.
That's amazing for that time period. What is, let me say it this way. When did the modern world, or do we have an accurate record of that? When did the modern world kind of find this or discover it? Or was there someone in the 1800s or 1900s that kind of, you know, let the rest of the world know it was there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I would say this, in terms of the West, you know, where we had the Greco-Roman, the tradition of the Enlightenment, ultimately. John Taylor wrote a book in 1859 called The Great Pyramid. Who built it? Why was it built? I'm pretty sure that was the exact title. Well, that was the year that Darwin published The Origin of Species, 1859. So I often say here's two books published in 1859 with a completely different view of where things come, because John Taylor in his book was led to believe that God had to have been involved in it, and he assumed the patriarchs had to be involved, because he began finding things like the value of pi, the close relationship to the size of the pyramid as a scale model of planet Earth. Like, wow, that's some pretty heavy stuff. It's like you have GPS way before GPS was invented, or you have some kind of superior wisdom. So he thought God was involved, and he thought the patriarchs involved, and he tried to figure out, you know, which patriarch it was. So that was 1859. Now, in that book, he takes the measurements of John Greaves, who was a professor at Oxford, and he studied different measurements and things around the world, and he was trying to ascertain what the length of the ancient cubit was, because I think he taught metrology or some similar science at Oxford. And so John Greaves is famous, and he was writing, I think, in like 1644. So John Taylor, in his 1859 book, sort of resurrects this kind of hidden work of him. And Isaac Newton, I studied Isaac Newton's dissertations on qubits in the Regenstein Library at the University of Chicago in the rare book room. In the rare book room, you could get a hold of a copy of Isaac Newton's dissertation on qubits. And because Newton was working on universal gravitation, he knew he'd have to have the size of the Earth to be able to accurately figure out gravity. And he knew the Great Pyramid was a scale model of the Earth. So the question was, And he labors in this piece to try and find the length of the cubit, including the sacred cubit that Isaac Newton said was the biblical the Hebrew temple cubit, which was 25 inches versus the national cubit, the common cubit, or the royal cubit, I guess it's sometimes called, was more like 20.6 inches. So Newton was just cracking his brain. And so most people that study what Newton came up with said he was a little bit wrong. He missed it because he was using Greaves' measurements, which were the best available. And at the time Greaves went there was before the 19th century, when they removed all the earth that was around the pyramid. So he could not get an accurate measurement of the base because none of the base was available to measure. The Great Pyramid was filled for, several thousand years with just, as a matter of fact, the casing stones, which covered the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid's built with limestone blocks that are from the quarry right there in Giza, but it was covered with highly polished Tura limestone, which is about 5 miles down the river from a quarry, 5 miles down the river. It's a much higher quality, almost like marble. And that's what the Great Pyramid was covered with. It's said to be 144,000 of these casing stones. Well, an earthquake in the 10th century knocked one of them out. And then the people in Cairo realized we got this great quarry source here. So they started just ripping off the rest of them. So many of the mosques in Cairo are built with the casing stones that came off the Great Pyramid. But the bottom ones were hidden because the sand was still there. And it wasn't until archaeology really took a turn to trend and there became a great worldwide interest in Egypt. You know, just things were coming out around the world like, oh, and this Egypt craze began. And so, archaeologists got involved and they spent the time and money and labor to remove all the sand. Then the lower casing stones were found. And then finally, Flinders Petrie, that's about the time he comes on the scene, he's able to get the first accurate measure of the Great Pyramid. And people, metrologists of all kind, whether you're, believe in aliens or whether you believe in Atlantis or whether you, believe in modern science, everybody uses Flinders Petrie as like a profoundly accurate survey of the Great Pyramid. And the Egyptian government commissioned another famous study in 1925 called the Coles Study. And those two, Flinders Petrie and the Coles, are still used by people who try and figure things out about the Great Pyramid. Those measurements are still used. And so the short answer is 1859, the Great Pyramid, who built it, which reached back a little bit farther to Greaves. But before Greaves, there's just some mentions in some Roman authors that the Great Pyramid was there, that there was supposedly a passage that went down there. And so there, you can say Diodorus and some of the other, I don't have all that history memorized, but some of the Romans did write about it. So there was a more ancient, writing about it. But it really, in terms of the modern time that makes it into the books that we read today that are more accurate, it would be John Taylor.
Tough question, Larry, and that is, if you can, you've put aside your research for just a second. The first time that you ever walked up to it, can you remember
totally,
what you thought?
Easy to remember. Here's why it's easy to remember. Those of you not in the studio don't know that I asked for a cup of coffee when I came in because I'm a little bit tired. I played tennis and I was tired. So I never have trouble sleeping. My wife suffers from insomnia occasionally, so I understand what a horrible thing that can be for people. I have never in my life had a problem going to sleep except the night before I went into the Great Pyramid for the first time. I stayed at the Mina House, which is the fancy hotel right next to the Great Pyramid. That's where Adam Rutherford used to stay when he studied it. And I was there with Zahi Awas. It was 2014. And the revolution had taken place in 2011. So the Arab Spring happened and, Libya and all these places went crazy. And so Egypt had a revolution. So tourism was dead. Cab drivers were lost. Mom and pop, hotels down the tubes. The hospitality industry dead in the water, depressed. Nobody was going to Egypt. They just had a revolution. A tour company, Archaeological Pathways, took a risk in 2014 and thought, let's try it. Let's try and get a group. So they outfitted a pretty big tour, and they hired Zahi Awas, the most famous Egyptologist who's still the face of Egypt. He was the director of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. He's in all the National Geographic specials, as I said. And so I signed on to that tour. I I said, look, I'm a school teacher. I can't afford the 15 days, but I can get off for the week that you're in Cairo. Can I just bite off that part of the tour? They said, contact us in a month. And I knew they were going to try and see if they could fill a tour without having to. And so I called them a month. They said, yeah, we'll let you come just for that. So here I am in the Mena House Hotel, knowing the next morning at 5 a.m, because when you get a private entrance like we had, you have to go in there before it's open to the public. The Great Pyramid is open to the public most days during the day. But if you have a private entrance like we did, where you get the pyramid to yourself, and I've had probably about 15 since then, 15 times where I'm the only guy with a few other people inside the Great Pyramid. So anyways, here I am unable to sleep. The guy who never has trouble sleeping, I couldn't sleep because I'd read about it, I'd studied about it, and now here I am, you know. So does that answer your question?
Well, you come upon it, though. So then
the next morning, so you're seeing, you know, it's dark, but you can see the glimpse of the sun getting ready to come up, and it's just this eerie, mystical feeling, and you see some of the stars twinkling above it, and, you know, just to go inside of it. But, you know, once I was inside, I felt like I've been here before because I studied it so much. I know so much about it. It's like I've been here before, not because it was some kind of deja vu or like a lot of people think they have a past life in Egypt. A lot of people, you know, think that. It wasn't that. It was that because I'd studied it so much. And then it took away some of the magic to it. Not in a bad way necessarily, but just like, okay, the jitters are over, you know, now I'm actually here. And I've been in it hundreds of times since then. And as I said, probably about 15 times in a private entrance where I, you know, because I lead tours myself. And so I'll often, you know, take a group in just us. And it's either very early in the morning or late at night.
Is there a question that to you is unanswered? Is there a mystery to you that you wish you could answer about it?
Well, really, you know, it's how was it built? I mean, I can Jean-Pierre Houdin is from a famous French architectural family. He got obsessed with the Great Pyramid and just put his memoirs on academia, and it's mostly about the Great Pyramid and how he labored to find out it was built. Matt Sibson of the Ancient Architects channel on YouTube, one of the largest YouTube channels, you got near 1 million followers, I think. He's done a bunch of programs about the Great Pyramid, very knowledgeable. When he interviewed Jean-Pierre Houdin, he said, this is the most knowledgeable man. Every question he had, Houdin had thought through. And I could get into more detail and stuff, but he really, I think his are the best theories. And he believes in there's an internal ramp. You know, the external ramp would have been the greatest wonder of the world because the Great Pyramid's the only one of the seven wonders of the ancient world still standing. Well, some people say it would be an even bigger wonder if you built a ramp all the way up to the top of that. There'd be so much stone, and that'd be as big as the pyramid. That's not the way they did it. And Jean-Pierre Houdin shows how there is an internal ramp system, and several discoveries that have been made around the pyramid, including these muon scans that were done showing where these voids were, kind of matches his theories. And so I think that they, you know, I'm sure, and his studies show this, they use counterweights. I mean, you know, if you put, they're good at rope making, so you put a big, heavy stone on one end and just have guys controlling that, you can move big, you know, heavy stones. But just, it's so interesting that the Egyptians, they have hieroglyphics of how they castrated bulls and how they plowed fields and how they made boats. They don't tell us how they made, for some reason, they kept that as a trade secret. You know, just like the trades in America, you know, you got to get a special journeyman license to become, you know, a pipe fitter, blah, 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 you know, whatever, carpenter, whatever. But there they seem to do the same kind of thing. It was like a trade secret that we don't know. But Houdin has put together, I think, and he has a very traditional view of the building of the pyramid, the time period, and the physical blocks, you know, because there's so many theories. It was kites flew into place. They used the sound. It was, you know, music. It was the flotation. It was the blah, blah. And you know, there's so many theories, but that's the one I think I'd love to have if someone would have had a motion picture back then, taking a motion picture of how they did it, I just think it would be so fascinating.
A 2024 question for you, Larry Paul, and that is, what is the condition of the Great Pyramid today? How is it holding up?
The head of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, Dr. Waziri, was just sort of fired, and someone's taken his place. I met with him several times and could tell some interesting stories about him, but he let this Japanese archaeologist have access to the Menkaure Pyramid, the third of the three pyramids, to renovate it. It, unlike the other two, because you think, well, why would the third pyramid be built so small? Like, why would you even do that when you're next door to these big brothers that are so huge? Well, one thing that Menkaure did different was entirely on the outside, it was granite, not limestone. So these casing stones are made out of granite, which is a harder, you know, more expensive stone. And so there's a bunch of scattered all around the pyramid. It only goes up about 16 courses. And so they were going to renovate that and add those courses of granite. And it led to a huge outcry among archaeologists around the world. Don't do that. Like, why? You have no idea where those go. You have no idea to do it. So just so it looks good, why should you reconstruct it? And there are people that have talked about plans to renovate the Great Pyramid, but that runs against the same kind of thing, because what condition it is in? Well, it's dilapidated on the outside, but the structure is still there. Because when you look at the Fifth Dynasty pyramids, I often take my tourists to the first pyramid built in the world, which is the Step Pyramid in Saqqara. It was the largest building in the world when it was built. It was the first pyramid built in the world. It began pyramid building in the world. And from the hill next to this, you can look off in the distance, and that's the Third Dynasty. It's the first pyramid of the Third Dynasty. You can look off in the distance then, and you can see the second pyramid of the Third Dynasty. It's totally gone. You can see the Fifth Dynasty pyramids. If you look over toward the north, and those are in Abusir, they're totally dilapidated. And then you can look off to the Fourth Dynasty pyramids in Dashur toward the south, the Red Pyramid, the Bent Pyramid, they're still largely intact. And then you can look to Giza, where the Great Pyramid is the pinnacle of the Fourth Dynasty, and it's still largely there. You know, the casing stones, I said, are off, but that naked structure that's left is still enough to protect what really probably the important part is, the internal passages. And let me say this about the internal passages. I was shocked to death that I had a paper accepted in an academic journal, Archaeological Discovery, that's going to be published very soon. I think this morning I sent off the last draft. I think it, because it's going to be in there. It's been accepted. And the subject of this paper is the speed of light numbers revealed through the lengths of the passages in the Great Pyramid in meters. So I thought it's such a long shot. They're not going to touch something that says the speed of light is in, you know, which is a modern 21st century, you know, finding is going to be in the Great Pyramid. But then I thought, well, why not submit it? Because measurement is the most scientific thing you do. So it's like a 50 page paper. Like I go to all the best measurements in the world of all the passage systems and get down to inches and half of inches of how long each one of these things is. So I can say accurately, well, this is 45 meters. Okay. So if it's the speed of light is 299,792,458 meters per second. It's 186,000 miles per hour, but in terms of meters, it's 299,792,458. So I show the passage systems basically going from the bottom of the pyramid, working up 29 meters, 97, 20, you know, let's see. 29, 97, 92, 45, 45, and 8. In other words, the length of the passages is 92. You know, so
wow.
The numbers and the speed of light, and these are the main passages. There's no passages not used. It's just the main passages that everybody recognizes. If you look at a slice, if you look at that side, usually you see the eastern elevation view of the Great Pyramid. When you see the passage system, there's the descending passage down to the subterranean chamber. There's the first ascending passage, there's the Grand Gallery, there's the King's Chamber, and then at the junction point, there's the horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber. That's it. Those are all the passages people talk about. I just gave the dimensions in meters to those from the bottom up, and it's the numbers and the speed of light. So that is going to be published in Archaeological Discovery, and I'm shocked to death, but I'm happy to announce it here that's, I think it was the final draft was sent out today. I met all the editors, you know, things, and so, you know, that says something about about that the the most important things are still there, because people tell me all the time it's a resonant machine, and it is a remarkable resonance machine. I could talk about that. The resonance inside the King's Chamber is unbelievable, and it's partly because of the way the room's designed. As a matter of fact, I read about the room that they have at Microsoft that people almost go crazy in. It's a room where if you go in there, you play a saxophone or something, there's no sound, because the way they built the walls, it absorbs everything. So it's a totally quiet room. So if you're in that room, it's like complete quiet, okay, because of the way it was designed. And the way the Great Pyramid, the King's Chamber, is largely freestanding, if you can believe it, almost freestanding in terms of, you think there's wall-to-wall blocks, but it's almost freestanding. And the resonance, people sing in there, esoteric groups go in there and they chant, they do, and it's unbelievable. So there is a tremendous resonance. That's resonance. There is a profound, you know, that's one of the profound elements of the Great Pyramid. So people tell me it's a machine. It's a resonating machine. And, you know, the great Tesla, supposedly it's a Tesla machine. I think that Tesla designed his tower based on the Great Pyramid. I don't think the Great Pyramid is the power plant, but I think Tesla designed it based on it. I think the Great Pyramid can be a source of inspiration for things like the Tesla Tower, but I don't think it is itself. I don't think there was a lot of streetlights in ancient Egypt that the Great Pyramid provided power to. I really don't. I think its main purpose is symbolic. And the numbers, the metrology, for instance, the speed of light. And I have an appendix in that paper that I list at least 12 other ways the speed of light is revealed in the Great Pyramid. But that's an appendix because I'm just talking about the passages of the Great Pyramid itself. But I'm saying there are many other ways that the speed of light is revealed. So somehow you've got to explain this very modern, you know, cutting edge, you know, number, the speed of light, which we thought is uniquely our 21st century deal. How could it possibly be in that Egyptian pyramid? And another one, a similar one, is the fine structure constant. You know, Carl Sagan said, he said, if you want to, you know, you're going to send that ship out in outer space and you want to try and communicate with those beings out there, put the fine structure constant in there. The fine structure constant is the cutting edge of modern physics, you know, maybe even more than the speed of light, because it's the coupling constant. It has to do with the edge between matter, molecules, and energy, light, and whether an electron will be released or absorbed, and it's the number 1/137. That's the fine structure constant. It's 0.000729. Its inverse is 137, so oftentimes the fine structure constant is referred. And it's just a number, because when you look at the formula from which it comes, which includes Planck's constant and some other things, they all cancel out, and what's left is just a number. So you can read, like, Richard Feynman, the famous atomic theorist, says it's like a God number. We don't know how he did it, but we all know it, this number's there. So the one piece of furniture, the one piece of anything that's in the Great Pyramid is the box that's in the King's Chamber. And I did the math on the plane coming home, because other people have said it. I wanted to study it for myself. I calculated the volume of the King's Chamber, used Flinders Petrie's numbers. He's the most accurate. And then the volume of the coffer. And that coffer, sarcophagus, box, whatever you want to call it, that's in the King's Chamber, the only accoutrement that's there, there's no gold, silver, jewels, nothing, except there's this empty sarcophagus. The volume is 1/137. The fine structure constant. The most amazing number that atomic physics can give us, that Carl Sagan says, put this in a rocket ship you're sending out to try and make contact with those beings out there. This is the number, and that sarcophagus is 1/137, if that you could fit 137 of those inside the Great Pyramid. So there's the fine structure. So you got the speed of light, the fine structure constant inside the Great Pyramid. Go figure.
As they say, it makes you think. Larry Paul, thank you for educating us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's fun talking to you.